CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
Before we get started, I'd like to thank our sponsors. Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter. And finally, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And this week's CFO Radio News is brought to us by CFO.com, and it is headed up, The Trouble with DSO, Days Sales Outstanding, and written by Alex Stewart of CFO.com. Days Sales Outstanding is not a good metric for measuring collections performance, experts say. Bandied about in earnings calls and the newspapers, DSO is commonly used to describe how quickly a company is getting cash it is owed into its coffers. But DSO doesn't cover everything a finance chief might want to know about the credit department. Indeed, most people, including CFOs, don't fully understand exactly what DSO is measuring, asserts Terry Callahan, president of the Credit Research Foundation. The largest part of DSO is sales terms, says Callahan, a factor most credit managers can't touch, he points out. And if terms are 30 days, chances are DSO is never going to get below 30 days. So while DSO is a good measure of the revenue to cash cycle, it's not a good measure of collections, in his opinion. DSO is also easily manipulated, says Callahan. Large increases in DSO can indicate a situation where a company is forcing sales by accepting poor receivable terms or selling its product at a discount to credit sales for the period he charges. Instead of DSO, the CRF recommends a different metric, the Collection Effectiveness Index, and they refer to this as the CEI. This metric looks at collections relative to accounts that have become due and not the current receivables that are unlikely to be paid early. What CEI looks at, says Callahan, is how much of what was collectible did we get. 100 is a perfect score, but the score could easily exceed that if a company asks customers for cash in advance. On that measure, it seems companies are improving. According to the CRF's latest quarterly survey, for the first quarter of 2011, CEI showed a marked improvement over the last year from 80.72 to 85.20, says Callahan. And on that good news, I would like to introduce Dr. Mark Frigo. He is joining us today as a leading advisor to CFOs and executive teams. He's a director of the Center for Strategy Execution and Valuation and the Strategic Risk Management Lab in the Kelistat Graduate School of Business at DePaul University in Chicago, and Ledger and Quill Foundation Distinguished Professor of Strategy and Leadership at DePaul. Dr. Mark Frigo is author of 6 books and over 100 articles. His work is published in leading business journals, including Harvard Business Review. His professional career has included corporate strategic planning mergers and acquisitions and management consulting at KPMG. Dr. Frigo is a certified public accountant in Illinois, a certified management accountant, and holds a PhD in econometrics. Dr. Frigo speaks, teaches, and consults globally, advising organizations in their quest to become high-performance companies. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you, Lorraine.
Well, Mark, before we get into the questions section of the radio show, I'd like to put a little remark out there for our listeners today. We're going to have a little bit of a competition going, and this is the first time we've done it. You've published some quite phenomenal articles, some of which I've read, and you've published some fabulous books, 6 books to be specific. And I recently read your book called Driven. It is an excellent book. I certainly program flipped from page to page, and it kept my attention very, very well. So to the listeners, stay tuned after the interview. We will have a drawing for a signed copy of Driven from Dr. Mark Frigo to go to one of our listeners. If you'd like to be entered into this drawing, please send your name and phone number to info@cforadio.com, and we will give that address out again at the end of the radio show, so stay listened. Well, welcome to the show, Mark. I'm going to get into the first series of questions. Let's start at the beginning. What was your first job, and how did you arrive? Where did it meander you to your current position?
Yes, Lorraine, that takes quite four decades, but I will try to summarize it. I graduated from the University of Illinois in the early 1970s with a bachelor's degree in accountancy, and I joined Waste Management as a financial analyst. At Waste Management, I had the opportunity to work in a very intensive merger and acquisition environment where the company acquired more than 90 companies in 1 year, and had the opportunity to also work for Wayne Huizenga and his team on the South Florida acquisitions. After that time, I entered graduate school for my MBA and completed my CPA and CMA during that time, working with Professor Don Kiso at Northern Illinois University in Illinois. And after completing my MBA, I worked in the corporate sector in strategic planning, where I worked for the Executive Vice President of Finance of Jewel Companies, a diversified retailer headquartered at that time in Chicago. I also worked as an intern at Continental Bank, now Bank of America, in Chicago during my MBA studies. Later, I worked as a management consultant in the Chicago office of KPMG. When, after completing my PhD in econometrics, I joined DePaul on the faculty, and I've been at DePaul University since 1980. In the last several years, I've founded a center, which I'll describe later, the Center for Strategy, Execution, and Valuation. And the center really is devoted to studying high-performance companies and making the connection between the strategy of companies and their ultimate valuation, which of course is a topic that CFOs are interested in. Recently, I've been presenting at CFO and CEO summits in North America, Europe, and Asia Pacific.
And in fact, Mark, that was where we met earlier in the year. And we were both speaking at a conference in Florida, and I certainly was captured by your presentation. I think that it was very informative. It showed a reflection of very positive aspects of how you can drive the business. So that really was key for me in connecting with you. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of your certification designations. You're a CPA and a CMA. Why did you take this particular path, and was there anything particular that led you to teaching? Because that's a path that many don't tread.
Thank you. The CPA and the CMA provided the credentials in accountancy that have helped me both in my business career as well as in academia. And I think the background from both those credentials provide the expertise and the discipline that I needed to develop a lot of the research that I've done and the application of that research in helping companies make the connection between their business strategies and shareholder value creation. The center also has spun off a lab, which we call the Strategic Risk Management Lab, which focuses on protecting shareholder value. And again, that my background as a CPA and CMA helped me to author and develop a COSO report on enterprise risk management and how to improve it. As far as teaching is concerned, you know, I initially had the opportunity to teach as a graduate student when I taught as a research graduate assistant for Don Kiso at Northern Illinois University. And teaching really, to me, is a lifelong activity, both as a professional in professional financial area and also as a professor at a university. But I think we're all teachers in many ways. In fact, I believe that the great CFOs that I've worked with, many of them display that trait of being great teachers and communicators, which I'll describe later.
And Mark, I would agree with you. Certainly, when I have reached out to CFOs to be guests on the radio show, they've been very encouraged by the fact that this really is educational. They're spreading their message. Mostly, they're very humble, and ordinarily they wouldn't get on a radio to talk about their background and experiences. But in a teaching and educational environment, which this radio show is, they're very willing to participate. Well, Mark, let's talk a little bit about return-driven strategy and the framework. You're the co-creator of the return-driven strategy framework, which is used by corporate management teams and board of directors to make a connection between the company's business plans and the market valuation. Tell us about the basic elements of this.
Yes, the return-driven strategy framework describes the activities that companies have displayed that have shown to result in sustainable high performance. And we define high performance in terms of three metrics. The first one is superior and sustainable return on investment. And this means having a period of time of at least 10 years where the return on investment was at least twice the cost of capital, which is difficult for almost any company to sustain over that period of time. Then they had to meet a second criteria, which was the company had to maintain that spread, ROI to cost of capital, and then grow the business above GDP growth. So they had to grow the business while maintaining the superior ROI. And the third dimension, which would obviously drive from the first two, is they displayed superior relative total shareholder returns, which would be capital stock appreciation and dividends, which would be expected, with the exception of if there were ethical in the conduct of the business. This framework is explained in the book Driven. Outside of the book Driven is business strategy, human actions, and the creation of wealth. And I think that kind of says it all, the subtitle, because it's really the business strategy describes the intentions of a company to create value for its shareholders and constituents. The human actions is the execution, and the result is the creation of value or the destruction of value, as we have seen in the last few years where companies have not done so.
And I was very much enjoying the reading your book because of the fact that you're not afraid to talk about the companies by name. You've certainly done the data and the analytics behind the companies that provide support to the three tenets that you've described. But you also have sections throughout the book that talk about the companies that have not done so well.
Yeah, we discuss some of the 100 companies that met our criteria globally for high-performing companies, but we also describe companies that have done the reverse in terms of companies that have destroyed value over a relatively short period of time, shareholder value, that is, and also companies that have been have had a difficulty in rising to a high-performance level.
Sure. Well, let me ask a direct question. How are CFOs using the return-driven strategy framework?
The return-driven strategy framework is being used by CFOs in three ways. The first way they're using it is to, in the current environment especially, is to develop focused growth strategies. And what I mean by that is growth strategies that are able to achieve more with less resources, given the current economic state we're operating in. And I'll describe that in more detail in a moment. The second way that they're using the framework is to develop strategic risk management in their organization and take a leadership role in enterprise risk management, focusing on the strategic risk of the organization, increasing the value of risk management, and really creating risk management as a competitive advantage within the organization, meaning that they can take more risks because they have the greater capability to measure and monitor and manage those risks. And the third way it's being used is by the CFO, him or herself. and the CFO team. And that would be for developing strategic leadership skills of the CFO and strategic communication skills of the CFO, the necessary soft skills.
Well, let's break that down, Mark. How are CFOs developing focused growth strategies?
Yeah, the work, Lorraine, the work that I've been doing with CFOs and presenting at various CFO summits is focused on really taking the framework as a lens and looking at a potential growth strategy and then refining it to be more effective in terms of how it can be expected to be able to drive sustainable returns, return on investment, growth, and ultimately shareholder value. In certain ways, it's used by some CFOs to conduct what we call a strategy audit, where the strategy audit is used on a particular strategic initiative to do an evaluation of it in terms of its connection and ability to drive shareholder value creation.
Well, let's talk.
It's also used.
Sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Mark.
It's also used by CFOs to balance managing the present, which is takes most of the time of CFOs and other management people, versus creating the future. And it really provides a way for CFOs to drive growth in terms of the core business, adjacent business growth, as well as new business growth.
So let's look at that. I love the idea of doing a strategy audit. It's a new term to me. And just from a perspective of how long would that take?
Well, strategy audit is something that can be done in a focused way on a particular strategic initiative. And it can be done with two goals and two benefits. One goal is to evaluate the strategy in terms of how well it's going to be able to generate the returns and growth and shareholder value. And that would be the strategy side of it. That would be the ability to create shareholder value. The other side of it is the risk management side, and that is looking at the other side of the framework, which is looking at the downside of risk, and that is identifying the potential strategic risk that would be embedded in a particular strategic initiative. As far as how much time it takes, if it's a focused process, it takes relatively a small amount of time because it's really a matter of applying the framework along with certain diagnostics, many of which are in the book Driven, to a particular initiative and then developing some recommendations based on it.
So how might a CFO approach this, I guess? And before we get into that, I have one question that I'm just curious about. When you go to companies and you meet with these CFOs and they're saying, Mark, how can I do this? And they will potentially be engaging your company to help them with that. When you give them that first set of statistical analysis, is there shock? Are they surprised by the numbers that they see?
Most CFOs are not shocked by the numbers. They realize they have a pretty good fix on their measures of return on invested capital, depending how it's measured. They have a good idea in terms of their growth as well as their stock price performance relative to the market. Many times they're looking at the absolute stock price as opposed to the relative stock price performance, which we look at in our metrics. But the most of the CFOs, they're not surprised by what I can show them in terms of how they look, let's say, to the investment community or to stockholders or to the outside market. But their challenge is to how to communicate their plans and their strategy to the market that will make that connection between how it's going to drive return, growth, and shareholder value.
And definitely taking that short-term, long-term capital investment, human investment, cost structure is one approach. They're going to need to look at all elements of each individual line item on their P&L and break that down from a balance sheet. Do they sometimes struggle between the P&L impact and the cash flow impact of doing this?
Well, the whole area of, if you look on the bottom of the framework, return-driven strategy, it says disciplined performance measurement and valuation. And that's the base foundation of the framework. We find that high-performing companies have a good fix on their profitability, their cash flow, as well as the balance sheet side, which means the investment side and the ROI side of the performance.
And obviously, the age alternative, making sure the balance sheet, looking at that future creation of value, and offsetting that with the short-term goals. How do you help CFOs manage that struggle? Because there often is almost I won't say conflict, that's too strong, but there's a balancing that needs to happen between that short-term and that long-term for that value creation.
Yeah, I think that we call that strategic balance and discipline. And in the framework, Return-Driven Strategy, it's tenet number 10, which is titled Balance, Focus, and Options. Focus is doing the current business as we're currently operating it. Options would be the new focused growth strategies that all companies in any way must continue to develop and execute on. So it's really, as you mentioned, Lorraine, it's an idea of balance between, you know, taking care of today's business and the short-term challenges of the business, but also focusing on the options for growth that the company must exploit in order to create value.
Sure. Well, how are CFOs getting involved with some operational aspects of this? For example, ERM, and strategic risk management.
In the area of enterprise risk management, you know, after the global financial crisis, enterprise risk management became more prevalent. The focus of the work that we're doing in our strategic risk management lab is on strategic risk management at the strategic level. We find that boards are asking CFOs to get more involved in ERM initiatives in the organization. And CFOs have, in fact, an opportunity to take a leadership role and to actually guide ERM in a more strategic direction.
You know, Mark, that's a very interesting element, because sometimes the challenge at that, not only the board level, but also the executive management level, is who exactly in the organization should take on ERM?
Well, that is an interesting question. It comes up quite a bit at many of the roundtables and the other presentations that I've made, and that is who owns risk management. And the fact is there's a lot of different owners of risk management in organizations. CFOs generally, I believe, should own strategic risk management, that is the creation and protection of shareholder value, as well as obviously the CEO. But we have all these other silos out there, such as internal audit and other areas of risk management that cover certain areas but are not necessarily focused on strategic risk management.
Understand. So how are CFOs developing these areas? Where would they start?
Are you referring to
the strategic risk management strategy?
Yeah, I think we see a couple of drivers of why CFOs are getting more involved in strategic risk management. I mentioned the boards are expecting CFOs to play a leadership role is one area. One reason. Another reason would be the SEC disclosure requirements for risk are changing and increasing. The rating agencies like S&P and Moody's are reviewing ERM in the rating process for rated debt. Also, I think that investor relations are now, you see more questions coming up in terms of risk management coming up in the process, and also government regulations are impacting it. So to answer the question about what CFOs are doing, really I think the CFO has a critical role in having the ability to integrate strategic risk management and risk management into the strategy and strategy execution processes of organizations. And I think that is where the CFO can play a critical role in many of the organizations we're currently working with globally. The CFOs are, in fact, playing a critical role in that integration.
And interestingly enough, you mentioned that at the board level, there is also some challenge of even who manages the ERM and the strategic risk management. Obviously, strategy operations isn't the board's responsibility, but they have a fiduciary responsibility to oversee from an officer perspective. Does it necessarily fall on the audit committee, or should this be a role and a task taken on by perhaps a new individual from the board of directors that would be this would be their focus and task?
Well, the audit committees have often been involved in various aspects of risk management. We have also organizations that have specific risk committees, or they have risk committees and audit committees that are linked or interrelated. So there's a lot of corporate governance structures that are being used to, in terms of the board oversight of risk management, that are being considered. It really is something that depends on the organization. We find what works well is for there to be a management group, a management risk committee, where the CFO would be a member, and that committee would oversee the development of risk management and strategic risk management as a core competency within the organization, involving the integration that I mentioned earlier.
That's a great tip. That certainly is a very good advice. So now we have the board involved and we have the CFO and the CFO's team involved. What are the next steps once you've perhaps kicked off your ERM program? You'd mentioned that after the global crisis, this became quite strongly focused upon. You may have just begun, a lot of companies may have just begun the outset of an ERM program. What is that next phase?
We found the most valuable way to build and improve risk management and governance within an organization is to conduct what we refer to as a strategic risk assessment. And we've developed a strategic risk assessment process, a continual closed-loop process, which allows organizations to adapt that process, use it as a way to either evaluate a particular strategy or a business unit strategy, and start integrating strategic risk management into their existing ERM programs. The article for that is on my website, markfrigo.com. It's entitled Strategic Risk Assessment. But that's become a process that CFOs have used very effectively to start the process of improving risk management.
And once they've done that, it's relatively perhaps recurring in nature. I won't say necessarily easy, but it becomes a recurring task to maintain tracking over the data points for that.
Yes, that's very critical, Lorraine, because the continuous process element is necessary. Many times when I interview or work with management teams, I'll ask them, well, have you done a risk assessment? And they'll say, yes, we've done a risk assessment. And many times they've hired an outside consulting firm to do a risk assessment, or they've done it themselves. And then I would ask the next question, okay, then what happens? And they would say, some elements of it were reported to the board. And then the next question and then what happens? And usually there's silence after that next question, because there's not a continual process that takes that risk assessment and creates a mechanism for continuously improving and developing the risk management capabilities and processes in the organization.
That's key. It's a little bit like going to the gym and having a goal for X, and then once you've achieved X, slipping back into the sofa is comfortable, the hamburger's comforting food, and maybe slipping back into what I would describe as bad habits. And we can have bad habits in the corporation, and certainly discussing these kinds of elements. Would it be appropriate for a company to maintain the recurring nature of this on a quarterly basis or a monthly basis? What would be most appropriate?
The most common way I see it being done is on a quarterly basis. But the initial, the most important thing is to take the initial step in starting the process. The time dimension in terms of how often it's done depends on the nature of the industry and the business, obviously, but that can be fine-tuned later. But usually developing quarterly updates would be critical.
Sure. Well, I'd like to jump approach a little bit, if we can, Mark, and talk a little bit about something you mentioned earlier in our radio interview. You mentioned about CFOs developing strategic leadership skills and strategic communication skills. In the CFO ranks, certainly, we're not known as being particularly eloquent speakers. That's something that some CFOs have naturally. And some CFOs are even going to a comedy school to learn about how to deal with analysts. Certainly when bad eggs and tomatoes are being thrown up from the audience, the comedian up on the stage needs to figure out how to deal with that. And CEOs and CFOs are actually going to comedy school to learn that. But bringing that down onto a more realistic level, strategic leadership skills, how does a CFO learn and how can they master strategic leadership skills?
That's a key question every CFO needs to consider. There's five strategic leadership skills that I often discuss with CFO teams, and I'll just go through them briefly and then focus on the strategic communication skill and how they can be mastered. The first is strategic thinking. And I think that's where the return-driven strategy framework can be very valuable to CFOs. That means aligning their thinking and communication with shareholder value creation and stakeholder value creation. The second is strategic risk management focused on protecting shareholder value. The third is strategy execution skills. The fourth is strategic communication skills, which I'll mention in more depth in a moment. And then the fifth is really building the team, building the CFO team, and building the brand of the CFO team within an organization in terms of strategic leadership. And I mentioned the idea of mastering these skills, and there I'm going to refer to my avocation. You know, mastery means focusing on what really matters for, let's say, a CFO and being really great at it. And we can't be really great at everything. We can be great at a certain number of things. Let's say five we just mentioned. That philosophy comes from my avocation in martial arts. I mentioned earlier to Lorraine that I've practiced and taught martial arts over 40 years, and I hold an advanced black belt in Shotokan Karate and teach at the oldest martial arts school in Chicago. But what I've learned from that is that mastery requires focus and discipline. And I'm going to quote Bruce Lee for a moment. Bruce Lee once was quoted of saying, "I do not fear the man who has practiced 10,000 kicks one time. I fear the man who has practiced one kick 10,000 times." So if you think about mastery, it really takes a dedication and discipline to practicing those communication skills and other skills that I'm going to refer to. The communication skills is something I think that that I notice when I speak with various CFOs and I hear them on the platform speaking with me or after or before my keynote presentations, really provides a lot of insight about how they can communicate not only internally, not externally, but also internally within the organization and therefore be a more effective CFO.
And very often in that regard, I have noticed that CFOs have a consistent timing trigger event, that being the quarterly earnings release, to talk to the public, but that many times those CFOs do not talk to their own staff and perhaps not to their company at large. And from a personal perspective, I believe that that is an opportunity that's missed, and would encourage CFOs to talk more freely and to talk more often.
Yeah, 10 and 11 in the return-driven strategy framework is entitled Communicate Holistically. And that framework, by the way, can be applied to a company, a business unit, a strategy of a company, or it can also be applied to the individual, the micro-level application, let's say the CFO. And that tenet really refers to communicating holistically in terms of how what you communicate is received and interpreted by your constituents, shareholders, employees, customers, etc.
And that being said, any kind of communication tends to be one of motivation. And I say that loosely, any kind. Obviously, there are demotivating ways to speak and communicate. But messages that are positive messages to give to your employee base can do nothing but improve motivation and morale. Messages that perhaps are informative about maybe elements of downturn or layoffs or some element of what one might describe as the negative that is occurring within the corporation, the mere fact that the executive is standing up there and talking about it and facing the facts, facing and informing the employees of, number one, this is the situation. Number two, this is what your executive team has chosen to do in order to combat and head that face on. But number three, this is what we're asking you as an employee team to support us in doing. And there can be very positive ways to gather data and information and always to ask our employees for assistance. And I'll give an example. In the beginning of the recession, there were many companies that went out and did what you might refer to as a survey, you know, a piece of paper that could be dropped in a confidential box as employees leave the door and go home for the night. And one company, and I apologize to the listeners, but I forget the name of it. It's actually in one of my D-books that are on Delaney LLC website. But it asked employees to give suggestions for improvements to the corporation, either facts or circumstances that management had been made aware of, or those that they had not been made aware of. And one individual said in his response that he worked in the basement level of the building and that realistically the fluorescent lighting somewhat offended him. He didn't like it. And as an opportunity to cut costs, rather than to have all these fluorescent lights that seemed to be sort of recessed lighting, he suggested to remove every other light bulb. And it saved the company that year $400,000. And that was, I believe, a combination of the cost of the light bulb, the cost of the electricity and various factors, the cost of somebody's time to go change the light bulbs and all those different things. So you can see that through communicating and asking on that double way, communicating outwards as well as communication inwards to the CFO, you can gain a lot of benefits.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%.
Well, we have a tradition on the show, Mark, to ask our guests CFO Tip of the Month. And from the perspectives of an advisor to CFOs, what is yours?
Yeah, my Tip of the Month would be for CFOs, develop your strategic communication skills. Improve your strategic communication skills and practice that at all opportunities, both internally and externally. Every CFO needs to be able to address two fundamental questions and clearly articulate the answers to these questions internally and externally. Number one, how does the company intend to create shareholder value? And number two, how does the company intend to protect shareholder value? That's the risk management element. This kind of strategic communication skill starts and begins with strategic thinking. The way you think determines the way you speak, the way you communicate. And I think that's where all of this kind of fits together. I think I mentioned the five strategic leadership skills. The first one I listed was strategic thinking. That leads to strategic communication skills. And that's what I think needs to be practiced as CFOs take on the daily challenges of clearly communicating internally and externally within an organization. Boards are recruiting CFOs with exceptional communication skills, and CFOs are being evaluated on those skills. So there's something that would be needed to be developed further, always considered to be tried to master it in this today's environment.
Well, that is a great tip, and certainly our listeners hopefully will be in a position to go read your book and go hone their skills as it relates to communication. Well, thank you very much to Dr. Mark Frigo, our guest today, for sharing his innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Lorraine.
Well, thanks also go to our contributor, CFO.com. And just as a reminder, if you would like to enter the drawing for Dr. Frigo's book, email your name and phone number to info@CFOradio.com. Thanks go to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to DelaneyLLC.com. Thanks to Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website is at financialexecutives.org. And thanks to National Association of Corporate Directors, advancing exemplary board leadership for directors by directors. They can be found at nacdonline.org. Well, this and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or know of one who'd like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.